Hello, welcome to In the Kitchen with Brett Thorne. I'm your host, Brett Thorne, Senior Food and Beverage Editor of Nation's Restaurant News and Restaurant Hospitality. My guest this week is Ravi DeRossi, the head of Overthrow Hospitality, which runs a bunch of bars and restaurants in New York City that serve only vegan food, including three new restaurants whose chefs are all women of color. If that seems a little too, on the nose or too of the moment or too woke or gimmicky, think again. DeRossi is a very savvy businessman and also the co-founder of the now legendary cocktail bar Death & Co. His heart is 100% behind his mission to create a more equitable, less cruel, more thoughtful society. But he also wants to make money doing that. He doesn't have all the answers for how exactly to do that, but his track record for running successful businesses in one of the most challenging cities in the United States, if not the most challenging, speaks for itself. You'll hear more from him in a moment, and you might notice his kind of idiosyncratic tendency to call Zila Caudillo, chef of his restaurant Eteria, by the name Alex. But first, I'd like to report on where I am, which is the Culinary Institute of America's Worlds of Flavor Conference in Napa, California. It's the fourth conference I've been to in just over a month, because since nobody could have conferences for about a year and a half, they're all being squished together right now. It continues to be nice to get out and to see human people face to face. It's a lot better than virtual conferencing, believe me. I've come to realize that you don't know how tall anyone is via video link, and that's the least of the problems. It's proven to be interesting as I meet people in real life, and they're much taller and much shorter than I thought. And of course, you have the serendipitous conversations that you wouldn't have otherwise, like at the Menu Masters celebration in October in Denver, at which Jennifer Jasinski was inducted into the Menu Masters Hall of Fame. I got to meet her mother, who told me about taking Jennifer to get her first cookbook at a children's bookstore when she was around 11 years old. Also, you get to eat different food, like the meal I just had at Press in St. Helena, California, which used to be a steakhouse, but now it's a local, seasonal, fine dining restaurant where Thomas Keller alum Philippe Tessier is in charge of the kitchen, and he's also a partner. And I had a dry-aged steak tartare paired with a 2015 Sangiovese from Grassi Wine Company here in Napa that was such a great experience all around that I'm telling you about it now in my podcast. It had spring peas and fermented black beans and a bunch of what looked like local weeds, and it was served with thick slices of delicious rustic sourdough. And I'm just filled now with the contentment that comes from a great meal. Unlike Ravi DeRossi, it wasn't vegan, but like DeRossi, it was a pleasure to get to know. And with that probably awkward segue, here's Ravi DeRossi. Ravi DeRossi, you are the founder and grand poobah of Overthrow Hospitality, right?
Correct.
And you guys have a mission to have wonderful, profitable bars and restaurants while not serving any animal products. Is that pretty much the one?
And it's more than just being vegan. There's more to it, but that's a big part of it.
So let's talk. Let's just jump in and talk about your philosophy and your general mission, which is implied by the word overthrow.
Yeah, it was, it's interesting. Before COVID, each of these restaurants was just individually owned by me, but I never had the umbrella company. We just were, I wanted to open a new place, so I would go do it. And then during COVID, I all I've done is work for 7 days a week for 15 years. I never really had time to sort of take time off and figure out how to restructure my company into one. And then when COVID hit, all of a sudden I've got all this time in my hands. And I think like everybody else in the world sort of went inward. And for me, going inward also meant going inward into my company, because I am my company. It's pretty much all I have done for the past pre-COVID 15 years or so is work, right? Work every day, almost 7 days a week. I don't take vacations. I I just worked. And millions of people around the world who all of a sudden found themselves with a lot of free time on their hands. People were going inward and, looking to better themselves, right? Doing yoga, meditating, working out, running. And I was doing all that sort of cliche sort of stuff as well. But on top of that, I also looked inward to my company and just sort of discovered, and I just reflected on the company and myself, and am I the person that I want to be at this stage of my life? Is my company where I want it to be? Is it the company that I want it to be? And I, I found a lot of holes there and a lot of things about our company that I didn't necessarily like, a lot of things I did like, and a lot of things I thought we could do to make it better. So that's when we came up with the new name Overthrow Hospitality, and thought we wanted to create bring all these companies under one umbrella and create the company that reflects our personal morals and values and make it a company that we can be proud of, right? We were already vegan, which is a huge part of what we do, but not all. In sitting around during COVID, during the shutdown, I realized that we were, of the 300 or so employees that we had, I think something of more than 55-60% were women or people of color. And I thought, that's awesome. I don't know how or why that was ever a choice that we made to do that, but I thought, that's really great. Let's make that one of our core values. Let's make inclusivity. It's already going on, but now let's take it a step further. And that's when we decided, we had these three great female chefs in our company who were all people of color, also all young, under 30. And we've been working with all of them for years, so we knew what they were capable of. So we thought, let's ask them, each of them, what restaurant they would want to do, and let's do it. Let's see if we can find a space and make it happen. So we did it. We did the Mexican restaurant with Alex. We did the pasta, fresh pasta place with Amira. And then we did Cadence with Shinari. And then also during COVID, inclusivity, compassion, these all became our core values of the company. And then we also, when the shutdown first happened, I remember reading an article talking about how schools were shutting down, and that it was like a New York Times piece, and it talked about schools shutting down and how many kids, that's where they get their one or two or three meals of the day was at school. Like, obviously, poorer families and whatnot. So we decided to keep five of our restaurants open at that time just to give free school lunches to kids. And it ended up becoming a thing. And we enjoyed doing it. And the kids and their parents and their families, we would let them come take five meals, take it home, share, give it to your brothers and sisters. Really quickly, we decided we liked doing this, and we wanted to, and we felt like it was within our ethos. We ended up opening it up to just anybody, right? Because in the first couple of weeks, we're like, okay, this is going to be over in a few weeks. Whatever. But then it just kept going and going. And you saw people were hurting out there. Crime rates were going up because people didn't have money. So we opened it up, and over the course of like 6 months, ended up giving away about 40,000 free meals. And then we eventually partnered with Jose Andreas and did another 10,000 meals to frontline workers. And this is sort of how we developed what Overthrow Hospitality was become. Community and charity became a huge part of what we wanted our company to be. So then we did a big Halloween event for kids that was all sponsored by Overthrow Hospitality, because we couldn't have Halloween last year. Who knows if we can have Halloween this year? We shut down a street. We set up 40 stations. We socially distance. And then we did free dinners on Thanksgiving for anybody that wanted free dinners on Christmas. And then we started, getting more employees to come and volunteer their time. And essentially that's what we did. I looked inward, just decided what was important to me in my life, and decided to make my company more of a reflection of myself.
So how do you do that and also make a profit?
I don't know yet. we I don't know how to answer that. We're still working on that one. We're still working. We are growing. You know, we're actually growing at a very rapid rate right now. I think the demand for what we do, I think COVID changed everybody's or a lot of people's opinions about where they eat, what they're going to eat, how they're going to do it, who they want to support. I think people are going to take it. We took for granted. We took nightlife and hospitality. We really took it for granted until it got taken away from us. And I think now people are really going to be a lot more pickier and choosier about where they eat and who, what companies they support. Right. And hopefully ours will be one that people will want to support. Some of our places that were open pre-pandemic, like specifically like Lady Bird and Avant Garden, that were already doing well, are doing double the sales. So it seems to be working, right? It seems to be working, but you know, we'll see if that continues.
Well, you have a whole bunch of bars and restaurants. How many do you have?
Correct. Well, I have two companies, right? So I've got Overthrow Hospitality, which I think we have 10, 11 places under that. I'm also a partner in Gin and Luck. Gin and Luck, we founded Death & Co. I was the founding partner in opening Death & Co. And under Gin and Luck, we have there's a bunch of partners in that company now. It started by Dave and I originally 15 years ago when we opened up the first Death & Co. Now we have three locations of Death & Co. Plus we consult on a lot of projects. We're managing a bar in South Carolina right now called Little Palm, and we're working on some hotel, getting into the hotel business. So under Overthrow specifically, I think it's like 10 or 11 right now. We've recently signed a deal to open up a restaurant in Colorado under Overthrow, and then we're close to signing a deal in Chicago as well.
And so I haven't eaten anything at Death & Co. in a long time, but I think you serve dead animals there, right?
Yes, we do. There's three main partners in that place, me, Dave, and Alex. And I don't have control of that company to make that decision to go vegan. We have since been adding more and more vegetarian and vegan options to the menu, but not fully vegan.
Now, let's give everybody credit and use their full name. So you have Dave and Alex, who are partners.
Yeah, Dave Kaplan and Alex Day. Are yeah. So Dave Kaplan and Alex and me started Death & Co. 15 years ago. Soon after, we brought in Alex Day to become a partner. Now we have several other partners. Devin Tarby's, she ran Proprietors, which was our consulting firm. She's now a partner in Gin and Luck as well.
And you also mentioned three women chefs of color, Shanari and...
Yes, Shanari Freeman. She's black. She runs the kitchen at Cadence. Uh-huh. Zila Claudio, she's been with us for years. She is running the kitchen at Etheria, which is vegan Mexican. And then Amira Garib, she's Egyptian. She's running the kitchen at Soda Club, which is just fresh pastas made daily.
So what I've always thought was cool about the way that you run things is you have cool bars that are vegan, but you make them cool bars with delicious food, and you don't, you know, harp on the vegan bit. Like, people probably wouldn't even notice that they're vegan unless they were really looking for a cheeseburger.
Yeah, we don't really, you know, everybody knows that we are vegan, but we don't need to tout it. We're, you know, I think our deal is really... 90% of our customers are non-vegan, right? So it's, I think over the last 10 years, due to several reasons, there's three main reasons why anybody would want to eat more vegan. And one of them is health, right? It's a fact, and it gets proven more and more. Every week there's a new scientific study that comes out, but the World Health Organization came out 6 years ago and said, it's a fact. It's science, it's proven that eating red meat is carcinogenic as smoking cigarettes, right? And every week there's a new study that proves more and more how bad eating meat and dairy is for you. The number one cause of death in this country is heart disease. It's science proven that the number one cause of heart disease is the consumption of meat and dairy. So that's one of the big reasons why more and more people are eating more vegan. Second one is just animal rights, right? They say if factory farms had windows, I don't know who said this, but somebody did. If factory farms had windows, we would all stop eating meat. in this day and age, right, with social media and all these different platforms and mass communication, we see it. Everybody in their Facebook feed or their Instagram, they see what really goes on in factory farms and the real suffering that goes on with animals. So another cause. The biggest one, which is leading to people eating more vegan, is climate change, right? Whether you believe in climate change or not, it's there. It exists. We see it with, you know, the fires getting worse, droughts getting worse, hurricanes getting worse. Just all over the world, you're seeing climate refugees. You're seeing people starving, people suffering. It's, you know, you can't really deny it unless you are trying very hard to deny it. And it's proven that one of the main causes of climate change is this methane in the air, which is mostly caused by factory farming. So I think people want to do good. People want to do better. Giving up meat completely is a very difficult thing to do. So people are, you know, they're making decisions to like Meatless Monday, to eat more vegetables daily, or eat vegetables all day long on Monday, or whatever it is they're doing. And those are the people, these people that want to do good, that are conscious. Those are the people that are coming to our places. So we're really catering to a palate that is not your typical vegan palate. We're catering to, we don't tout the vegan thing. People know, to get back to your original question, but we also include all the salt, fat, acid, and heat that you find in really quality food, which is mostly meat-based. We include that in our vegan cooking.
Right. Yeah. It's not health food per se. I mean,
we have a ton of fried stuff. We've got some salads here and there and whatever, but yeah, we're not catering to that health nut vegan. We're catering to just a conscious vegan.
Right. Like your corn ribs, which I really love, which are just corn on the cob that's kind of cut into strips and then fried and then served with some creamy, awesome sauce.
Yeah. Yeah. They're really awesome.
They're delicious. Yeah. So did you start out saying I'm going to open vegan bars, or was it I'm going to open bars and let's figure out what the food is?
You mean 15 years ago when I got into the business?
Yeah.
No, I wasn't even thinking vegan at the time. I've been an on again, off again vegan since I was 12, and I didn't know why. I stopped eating meat when my parents ate it. It had nothing to do with my background or anything like that. I just stopped, and had no idea why. I had no relationship to animals. I just thought, I don't know why. I just wasn't in touch with myself. I didn't know why. You know, you're a kid, you're 12 years old. You don't know why you do things. You just do things. That was the first time. And, you know, and over the course of the next 20 years, I'd start eating meat again for whatever reason, or I'd stop. Sometimes it was too poor. I was cheaper to eat meat than it was to not. I was an artist most of my life, and that's what I did. And I did it very successful, or whatever that means, successful. I was able to support myself as a painter. Then when September 11th happened, it became a little bit more difficult. People didn't know what was happening with the economy. They thought it might collapse. So people weren't spending as much money on luxury items as they had been. So I couldn't sell paintings. I was living here in the East Village on 7th Street between 1st and A, running out of money. I hadn't worked in years. I hadn't sold a painting in years. So 2004, I was a huge alcoholic, right? I was a total wino. I used to just sit at home and drink wine and paint and write. And I would just do that for days and days on end. Running out of money, thinking, what am I going to do? I've never worked for anybody in my life. I don't know how I'm going to go get a job. So with the last bit of money I had, I opened up a tiny little wine bar right across the street from my apartment on 7th Street, and it was called the Bourgeois Pig. And we opened, and I thought, I have to have some food, right? I have to serve something with wine, right? We had this, I did everything at the time. I actually found this space. I taught myself minor plumbing. I taught myself minor electrics. I taught myself carpentry, and I built this little bar. I did everything. I worked there 7 nights a week for almost 2 years straight. Did the wine list, thought, what's going to go well with wine? And I thought, cheese, right? It's timeless. Wine and cheese will always go together no matter what. There will never be a time when people don't want to do wine and cheese. So I started learning about cheese. I taught myself how to make fondue and all these sort of things. And we became this wine cheese. And then I thought we needed something sweet. So I added chocolate to it and start making chocolate fondues and getting these great chocolates from all over the world and opened up this tiny little place with wine, cheese, and chocolate. And we were packed. Like just crazy packed. I was drinking like twice as much as I had been before because I was working there. You know, I was like, it was so small. It was two people every night. That was it. There was two people. There was this Mexican kid in the back, Tony. He did all the dishes and made all the food. And I made all the drinks, served all the drinks, bussed all the tables and took all the orders, right? So it was just the two of us. And we worked every night together. And just, we had a blast. We had so much fun. Like to go back to that day would be great. But it wasn't vegan, right? And it took, and then so that place was lying out the door 7 nights a week. And then I met Dave Kaplan. He lived above the Bourgeois Pig, and he used to come in almost every night. We'd have a drink together and talk, chat. And he introduced me to the whole cocktail world. Took me to Milk and Honey and Little Branch and Pegu and Flatiron. There's only a few cocktail bars in the city at that time. And he sort of introduced me to all that. And then we decided we wanted to open a bar together. I was looking at the space around the corner where I was actually going to move the Bourgeois Pig into because I needed a bigger space. But we decided to put Death & Co. there instead. So then we got about Death & Co. Death & Co. became this like almost instantaneous like phenomenon, did very well. Then I opened up Maya Well after that, the tequila bar, then Cienfuegos. And then I had a series of cocktail bars that were all doing very well. And then I wanted to get into, then I thought, let me give the restaurant industry a try. Let me try more food-based concepts. And this was still not vegan and I was still drinking every night and my conscience had sort of just like left me. Right. I just didn't really, when you're drinking that much, you're either hungover or you're drunk and that's just how you live. And anything in between morals, values was just, had just left. So kept doing these places, got into restaurants, opened up three seafood restaurants that were all doing very well. And then I had this, you know, and I'm trying to make a long story very short. At some point I was like, my company just kept getting bigger and bigger and I was drinking more and more and there's no way I could have continued this. So I thought I got to get sober, right? So, and also along the way, I had adopted, a girlfriend convince me to adopt a dog. I fell in love with, got another dog, found a cat, took it home, took another cat home, got another cat. So I thought I'm going to move to Brooklyn, take my animals with me, get an apartment with a backyard and just stop going to my bars and restaurants at nighttime and sort of sober up that way. I did do a small stint in rehab. It just wasn't for me. I found some fancy rehab upstate that allowed you to bring your animals. And after a week, I was like, this is definitely not for me. I don't want to give up drinking. I just want to learn how to control it. So I lived in Brooklyn for a couple of years and basically quit drinking altogether. I mean, maybe once a month I'd have couple of drinks with dinner and that was it. And I still, you know, now it's 8 years later and I don't drink that much. When I went through that period of sobriety, my conscience just like hit me like a ton of bricks, right? All of a sudden I'm like, oh my God, what have I been doing? You know, and I think I read an article around that same time that it says something about how restaurants do 10,000 times more damage to the environment and people's health than the average person. I thought, wow, I think at the time I maybe had 15 places or something. And I thought, wow, this damage I'm doing to animals, to the climate, to people's health, like it's just not good. And at that same, right around that same time, one of my cats, whom I was very close with, got very sick. And the vet said he's going to die. He's got heart disease or something. And whether he dies next week or next year, we don't know, but he's going to die. And so I stayed home with him for a few months and he would just sit on my chest. And I had a very interesting experience, right? Like I've never had a TV. So I was just sort of just keeping a journal and about everything and my life and whatnot, and just hanging out with this cat, Simon, who was dying. And at some point I was struggling. I'd never been through this. I'd never lost a person that was close to me, much less an animal. And watching him, you know, he was struggling to breathe. You could tell. And at some point, I was really struggling, I think more than him. And at some point it felt like he was taking more care of me than I was taking care of him. Like, he was sort of comforting me through this process, because I was really, really struggling. And and the next morning was Christmas, I think 2016, he passed away that morning. And that day I thought, that's it. That's the end. I am not going to serve meat or dairy in my places anymore.
So it's only been 5 years.
Since 2016, correct.
Not quite, a little less than 5 years.
Yeah.
Because we're not at Christmas yet. So I want to talk a little bit more about alcoholism, because there's a lot of that in the restaurant industry.
Correct.
And you have figured out how to drink a lot less but still drink. Is that a struggle, or is that part of your constitution?
You know, I don't know. I let's just say I've quit a lot worse than alcohol. So on my own.
Bohemian life as an artist. You've done.
Yeah. I just made the commitment to do it. Right. I have that sort of personality. I don't knock anybody who struggles with it. I just have that personality where I either do something or I don't do it. Right. And if I do it, I am all in, 100% committed. And I was all in and 100% committed to being an alcoholic. I am all out, 100% committed to not being an alcoholic now. I don't like drinking that much anymore. I think as you get older, your hangovers get worse. And when I do, like, we had an engagement party last week, and I drank a little bit, and the next day I feel like hell. It takes me like 2 days to recover. So I think I feel very fortunate, you know, my hangovers are bad enough that it deters me from drinking. You know, I have one of my business partners, he doesn't get hangovers. And I was like, oh my God, if I had that gift, I'd be dead.
Right, right.
Yeah. You know, like, I used to smoke two packs a day, pack to two packs a day. I wake up in the morning now, I have a coffee, I have one cigarette, and I've been doing that for 10 years.
Great. So it sounds like maybe you don't get chemically hooked to things the way a lot of people do.
Yeah, I don't know if that's really a possibility to not be chemically hooked, you know, like, but it's working. Whatever it is, I have some gift that I'm not gifted. I'm just very fortunate.
Yeah. Since being a food writer, I drink for free a lot.
Yeah, that's kind of suck.
Yeah, well, if I were inclined to be an alcoholic, I'd be an alcoholic.
Yeah.
Instead, you know, I drink as much or as little as I want, and it doesn't seem to.
Yeah, I think about journalists. I do a lot of interviews, and I'm like, your job is to go out every night, and you have to drink, and you have to eat, and like, I just couldn't do it, man. It would be a tough job. I did that for a long time, and now I'm like, I go out not even once a week. I'm home by like 5-6 o'clock in my apartment.
Yeah, it can be exhausting, but then I was home for 13 months, you know.
Yeah, I know. And now you're like, oh, I want to go out every night. That's how everybody feels.
But now I'm doing it differently, which I'm really enjoying, because I used to do it for work. So I would commute into Midtown.
Yeah.
And then restaurants would say, come to this place, come to this, go here, do this. And I would go and see what was going on at all the hip, trendy places. Now I work from home. I live in Park Slope, which is a nice part of Brooklyn, but it's not particularly hip and trendy.
Yeah.
But it's nice.
I was living in Carroll Gardens for a couple of years. Yeah.
Carroll Gardens is a little more trendy, generally better food and bars. But I'm now a regular at least two bars in my neighborhood, possibly five, depending on how you get regular.
Yeah.
And it's fun, you know. I'm making a bunch of new friends.
You don't take it for granted so much anymore.
Right. Well, and I'm allowed to do it because since I'm working from home,
yeah,
I save an hour and a half worth of commute and can get to know my neighborhood, which
that's
is
great.
It's been spectacular. So I want to talk to you more about your three new restaurants, right?
Yeah.
Cadence, Ateria, and Soda Club. So let's talk about them. Let's do one at a time.
What do you want to talk about them? How they came about? How?
Yeah, how they came about and what they are, and tell me a little bit more about these awesome female chefs of color.
So it started with, like as I said earlier, just wanting our brand to be part of this, wanting inclusivity to be important to our company. And then approaching these three women who were already in our company. Amira Gharib, the Egyptian, she was already the executive chef at Mother of Pearl and Honeybees, two of my cocktail bars, one barbecue, one tiki. And she had been there. So, and she had always talked about pasta and how pasta was like, she had this sort of like passion for pasta. So that was sort of an easy sell. When we said, Amira, hey, we've got this space available, or there's a space that just came available. Landlord's offering us a pretty good deal on it. It's small, but it's cute. It's nice. We can get this open pretty quick. Are you interested? And what do you want to do? And of course she said fresh pasta. We thought perfect. One of my business partners, Drew, he's a huge like wine, natural wine guy. So we thought perfect. Let's combine these two natural. So we have like 250 bottle list plus just fresh pastas that they literally make every single day. Food is excellent.
And that's Soda Club. And, yes. And what is Drew's last name?
Brady.
Drew Brady. Okay.
Yes. Yeah. He is now a partner in Overthrow Hospitality.
Oh, great.
And then Amira, who had been the chef at Mother of Pearl, then Honeybees, then Soda Club, is now been promoted to executive sous chef of our entire company.
Awesome.
And then I had Zila. Zila, we hired 4 years ago, straight out of culinary school. She went to CIA, I believe, and they had a vegan culinary section. And she came in as an extern, did her 6 weeks. We liked her. She liked us. We offered her a line cook job. She took it. She was as a line cook for 2 years. There's only three line cooks. It's just a very, very small restaurant, 30 seats. There's only three people that work at a time. So she knew everything about the business because she had been there for so long. The chef passed away. The executive chef, Tony, had passed away. And we asked her if she could fill his shoes, not as executive chef, but as executive, a CDC, essentially, chef de cuisine, still cook his food, but run that kitchen. And she did it. And she did it wonderfully for about a year, year and a half. Everything was going very well until the shutdown. And then and what's funny about this, how the Mexican thing came up. So she's Mexican from California, but second generation Mexican. It's very American. And she used to make for staff meal at Avant Garde and pre-shift. She would like make nachos or tacos or whatever, just for fun, right? For everybody to eat before we started the night. And I would always go over there because I had them once. And so I would try to make a habit of like around 4 o'clock, because the restaurant opened at 5, stop by to see if she had made anything. And not most of the time she hadn't, but there was probably 10 or 12 times that she had made some sort of Tex-Mexi type or Mexican type dish that for the staff, that, and it was just always so amazing. So we asked her if she was interested. I said, I found this other space. This is a beautiful restaurant space. They're just, whoever it was decided to close, I'm going to take it. I've been negotiating with the landlord. They've accepted my offer. Do you want to do a Mexican restaurant? She seemed very excited about that. So that's how that came about. And then Shinari was, we had hired her originally. We knew she was a chef, but she had front of house and back of house experience. And though she had applied for a chef or a line cook or CDC or sous chef, something, she just applied for a kitchen position. We said, we don't have one. I don't remember when she applied. We did not have a position available at the time. So we asked her if she was interested in coming on as management, front of house management, because she had that experience as well. And we liked her. And she was. So we hired her to be the chef at Avant Garde. I got confused with it. We hired her to be the manager at Avant Garde. And then sometime when this whole thing happened, another space came available almost right next door to Avant Garde, just a couple doors down. And we took it and asked her if she was interested in doing, it was a tiny little place. You've probably seen pictures maybe. asked her if she was doing, and we asked her what she was interested in doing, and she said vegan soul food. And we thought, perfect. It's kind of the same idea we had, but we both had it together. And that's how Cadence came about.
And Cadence, according to my notes, also features wines from Black-owned
producers. Yes. We decided, I mean, that was Shinari's idea originally, and we all obviously jumped on board. We thought it made perfect sense. All of our beers, all of our wines are only purchased from Black producers.
And she is originally from Virginia. So are there a lot of Black-owned wineries there that you know about? Or?
Not that we know about. We've been looking and searching for more and more Black. Our wine list is very small. It's maybe 7 wines right now. Finding wines that are majority owned by Black people is not an easy thing to do. And when we find one, we're like, great, let's order 10 cases. We run out of those 10 cases very quick. We go to get more and we can't. They're out. So it's been a struggle. And so one of our goals of this quarter for our office manager or our director of ops, is to, because there are some great Black beer producers that aren't distributed in New York right now. So we're actually trying to make work out with them to try to help them and figure out what it's going to take to get their beer distributed in New York City. So, and we're also reaching out to Black wine producers to see what is it going to take to get your wine distributed in New York. It's not an easy thing to do. So, but fortunately we're managing now with it. It's a small restaurant. It only seats 12 people inside and 16 people outside. So having a 7 bottle wine list is probably fine for now.
And when did these places open?
When did they open?
Yeah.
I think, I don't know. Cadence maybe 5 months ago. I think Cadence opened first, like 5 months ago. Etheria opened 6 weeks after that. And Soda Club opened 6 weeks after that.
Gotcha. Yeah, Etheria was the first event that I went to after I was vaccinated. There, you had
a what event did you go to?
It was a launch of a tequila.
Oh, yeah. It was Denada tequila.
That was it, yes. And I met Zila there, and it was a little surreal to go out and, you know.
I imagine it was, yeah.
But at the same time, I felt, you know, kind of like Superman because I was vaccinated.
Yeah. The first time I went to a restaurant, other than mine, was probably like 2 months ago. And it felt really strange.
Yeah, well, now I'm used to it. I know how to use my phone to, you know, put the camera of the QR code, order from there.
Yeah, I still haven't figured that out.
Oh, it's not that hard.
Yeah.
And other than that, I don't know, I guess I've just gotten used to it.
Yeah, I'm really enjoying staying at home. And you know what's funny is I, for the first 15 years I was in this industry, like, I'm running my own business, right? Every day there's a disaster. My job is to put out fire, right? That's all I do. Taking a vacation was like, seemed like the most far-fetched thing ever. And I never did it. I just never, if I left town, I'd go to LA because I had a work-related meeting there. I was looking at a space, or same with Denver or wherever. I never took vacations. And I took my first vacation in 15 years, about a year ago. In the middle of this, my girlfriend and I rented a cabin in Vermont. In the middle, you know, we just drove up there, stayed for 2 weeks in the snowy cabin, and it was the most, didn't do anything, you know, a few work meetings, but really minimal, and just enjoy. I didn't know that side of living, that relaxed sort of like, and it's been really, really good. We actually, you know, we came back from Vermont a few months later. We went to Puerto Rico for 10 days. Then we just came back from Greece, spent a month in Greece. You know, this is things I never could have done during, you know, regular, normal work. So I'm actually really enjoying it.
So how did you manage to look after your dying cat for several months while running a million restaurants?
So when Simon was passing, this is when I was going through my just getting sober period. So I had stopped working. It's not that I stopped working. I moved to Brooklyn. And my office was in the East Village. All my restaurants and bars were in the East Village. And I stayed home. I did a lot of work just from home. I would come into the office for maybe an hour a day, every day. And that would be it. So other than that, I just stayed home with Simon. I didn't do, you know, I was just working from home basically for about a month and a half before he finally passed.
So apart from being someone who can drink or smoke in moderation, you also don't seem to have an adrenaline addiction, which a lot of chefs and restaurant operators do, that you have to keep busy all the time running around.
Well, you actually I think I did, right? I think maybe that was, you know, if I have a million things going on at one time, I get them all done. When I've got two or three things going on, I don't get anything done. But, you know, I was constantly opening up new places. And I don't, even when I wasn't, didn't have the time, like the right right space, right deal would come along and I would take it. So, but I'm not that adrenaline junkie like you see that chefs. Like, I don't work in my restaurants. I haven't in, you know, 10 years. So I'm not that guy running around. I'm the guy now sitting in the office kind of making sure everything gets done. And I check on things here and there. But no, I'm not that, I guess, that adrenaline junkie that you're talking about.
Yeah, there are many. So you started providing free school lunches and then free meals to whoever needed it. You worked with World Central Kitchen, Jose Andres' organization.
Yeah.
Are you still doing that?
We are not right now. It's definitely like it's part of who we are to the core, pardon the pun, but charity and community are important to us. So we're always looking for different ways to give back, right? I also run a nonprofit called BEAST. It's a nonprofit organization. It stands for Benefits to End Animal Suffering Today. So we're, it's strictly an animal, right? We just raise money and give it to organizations that are on the ground. One thing I'm trying to do with that is we're looking at buying a farm. This will take time to get done, but we're looking at properties now. We're going to buy a farm somewhere in the Hudson Valley that we're going to turn into a shelter / bed and breakfast for dogs, right? So where you could actually come and stay the weekend up there, have amazing food, spend a whole weekend with these dogs and hopefully find one that you like and then take it home. That's a project that we're working on. It's probably like a 2-year timeline. But, you know, we're going to do another Halloween event for the kids in the neighborhood. We're not giving away free meals right now just because we don't have the capacity to do so, because all of the restaurants that are open are super busy. But we will find different outlets of how to give back as much as we can, for sure. Right now, it's just we've been focusing on the last 5 months. We opened up 3 restaurants in 5 months, and I haven't been able to do anything other than focus on getting those 3 restaurants open.
Well, and how are you managing to do that with this labor shortage that the entire planet is talking about?
You mean getting these restaurants open?
Yeah. Yes, and you know, getting them staffed.
And you know, yes. So we had a lot of trouble finding people. Fortunately, a lot of our original staff wanted to come back. And I think, you know, when we put ads out there saying we're looking for people, I think there's a lot of people who are vegan or animal rights advocates or consider themselves hardcore environmentalists that want to work at a company and they're passionate about working at a company that aligns with their morals, right? So it's been easy for us to track people with like minds. Well, you know, we had some struggles in the beginning. Like in the beginning, we only opened 5 days a week because we couldn't get enough staff to open 6 days a week or 7 days a week. And our chefs, we didn't want any of our chefs working more than 5 days a week. So we started with 5. Just recently, Avant Garden has gone to 6. Lady Bird went to 6 and now went to 7. Soda Club, Etheria are still at, Etheria just went to 6. Soda Club still at 5. Cadence is at 5. We're trying to get it to 6. We've struggled with it, but they're also very small places. They're not these huge like Danny Meyer restaurants where you have a staff of 250 people per restaurant. The staff of Cadence right now is 4 people, the entire staff. Well, one manager who oversees 3 of our restaurants. She's one GM who oversees 3 restaurants. And then there's 4 people and they all work together 5 days a week. We're trying to figure out how to get to 6 and 7 days a week, so looking for more staff now. But we've had some struggles. I don't think it's been as bad as it's been made out to be. Or maybe I've just been lucky and we've been able to attract like-minded people. Like, I'll take this job because it fits my own values.
Right. And do they tend to stay a long time?
Yes. I think when you hire people, not because of their skill level, but because of their passions and their morals and their ethics, they work harder, they care more, and they stay longer. And we're just finding that out now. And it's great, actually. You know, like you walk into our restaurants and these people are, our staff cares more about the customer service and they care more about everything than they used to.
I would think also if you have a small staff, like if someone quits or doesn't show up, they know that they're screwing over everybody else there and they probably like them. So they don't want to leave.
There's probably something to that theory. Yes.
And you pay them well, I'm guessing?
Yes, we try to as well as we can. You know, with the three chefs, we've made a deal with them to cut them into the profits. With Amira, Shinari, and Alex, there are none right now, but I think there will be pretty soon, but they will all be cut in. They're paid well, and they will be cut into the profits when there are some. And we also, like I said, with Amira, who just went from, after 3 or 4 years with the company, went from chef of Mother of Pearl, then Honeybees, to Soda Club. Now she's executive sous chef for the company. Essentially, like, it's a term lawyers use, but she's on the partner track. She will eventually, if she continues with our company, become a partner in the umbrella company of Overthrow Hospitality. So there's something to work towards, right? Shinari and I chat about this a lot. Because there's not a lot of chefs that can do what she does. And so I have constant conversations with her about where does she see herself in the future? Like, what does she want to be doing? Is this enough for her, this tiny little restaurant for now? And she has said very clearly to me, she goes, Robbie, in the end, I want to become a partner in Overthrow Hospitality. I like the idea of being able to work on different menus that are from all ethnicities and all parts of the world and working in different cities all the time. So that's something that she wants.
That's great.
You
said they're not right now. There is no profit, but the restaurants are super busy. So what's the holdup? You need to be busier. You need people to drink more.
Yeah. Well, like I said, they're only open 5 days a week, right? And you really need these open 7 days a week to get them to profitable. At least 6 days a week. Lady Bird and Avant Garden have been around for a long time, and they have built in customer base, and they're super profitable right now. Like, they're kind of guided, and Amoria Margo as well. Cadence is such a small restaurant. It's almost impossible to make that place profitable with the level of service and the quality of the food we're serving. But we knew that when we did this, and we knew very quickly we needed to expand it. So even before the New York Times review came out of Cadence, we had taken the space, signed the lease for the space next door. So we are already in the process of expanding Cadence. I expect that once, because we turn away a ton of people right now. We can't, you know, if it's raining, we've only got 10 seats inside, 12 seats. So we can only do so many customers.
Right.
But now we're taking the space next door. We're adding 30 or something more seats inside. So I imagine once that opens, which will be like October, November, that place will become profitable. Soda Club has actually just in the last month hit that break-even point. They got there very quickly. Etheria is taking a little bit longer, but I'm not too worried about it. I think we overstaffed in the beginning, and now we're sort of realizing what the actual staff is, what is required. And so, I mean, we always do that in the beginning. We like spend a lot of money, make sure everything's perfect, and then sort of pull back where we can. Right? That's what like my job and my operations team is to do, is get the place open, make sure everybody's, all the customers and staff and everybody's happy. And then after 3 months, sit back and analyze the financials and figure out how to make money. I don't really worry too much about making money in the first 6 months of any restaurant. If it happens, awesome. If it doesn't, it's kind of expected.
Well, and it has with Soda Club. Does it help that it's a pasta place?
That the food cost is very low, I guess is what you're referring to.
Right.
No, I don't think that makes much of a difference because it still requires the same amount of labor. We got a really good deal on that restaurant, and it was already a beautiful space. Our rent is low. It was already a beautiful space. It didn't cost a lot of money to get open. It takes less people to run that place than it does some of our other places. And they've got, so Cadence and Soda Club run with the same amount of staff, exactly the same amount of staff, but Soda Club can seat 30 more people.
Oh, makes a big difference.
So it can do higher sales on the weekend. So once Cadence has that room next door, I imagine it'll very quickly get to break even or profitability.
Well, I hope so. And
I do too.
And wish you very much luck and success.
Thank you.
Ravi DeRossi, it was a pleasure hanging out with you for a while and talking to you.
Brett, nice chatting with you.
Likewise, and I hope to see you in real life soon and eat some corn ribs.
All right, well, please come by one of our restaurants. Let me know when you come.
I'll do that.
All right, thank you.
Thanks.